a reading service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. Cover story this week, where growth is going. Greater Triangle boards chart the area's future. Before we get to the cover story, we'll read the biz section and the reporter pages. The biz section is written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Attendance is up at Courage Games. The North Carolina Courage are seeing a surge in interest this year as interest in women's sports spikes upward after the NCAA women's basketball tournament. The women's title game drew 18.7 million viewers, beating the men's game by 14.8 million for the first time. It's having a ripple effect in a positive way, says Francie Gottsagen, the president of the North Carolina Football Club. A rising tide lifts all ships, and women's sports are on this incredible trajectory. The fan base is exploding, and the corporate support is there. While Caitlin Clark isn't switching sports and suiting up for the Courage, the team is 4-2 and tied for second in the National Women's Soccer League. Last year, the Courage averaged 5,384 fans per game, ranking 11th in the 12-team league. This year, the club averaged 6,251 fans its first four matches. The April 27th match drew 8,135, helped by a promotion with the local youth league. The encouraging sign is attendance rises as the season progresses. Gottsagen also says corporate support is up 40% this year, a big jump that comes at a time when the NWSL has fresh exposure thanks to a new broadcast deal. Last year, the league had 18 games on national television, and this year there are 120. The Courage jumped from one appearance last year to 13 this year, so it's a significant increase, she says. And while the cash matters, the exposure is critical, both for the club and sponsors such as Mertz. It's all very much connected, Gottsagen says. Gottsagen has pushed to improve the game day experience, and having Fenton nearby has helped. But some challenges remain. Wake Med Soccer Park in Cary seats 10,000, but parking isn't easy. A key reason the team dropped charging for parking this season and just incorporated that into the ticket price. The club also wants to improve the locker room and training facilities. Where the club plays in the future remains uncertain. Gottsagen says the club could remain in Cary or one day move to a new downtown south facility, and that conversations are ongoing with both cities. We're trying to figure out the best solution, she says. Chef Preeti Waz shuts down Raleigh Restaurant. An acclaimed Raleigh chef has closed her restaurant in North Raleigh as the city's food scene continues to face ups and downs. Preeti Waz closed Cheney Indian Food Emporium on April 22nd. It opened in 2022 at the Falls River Town Center. Preeti, who has twice been nominated for a Best Chef Award in the annual James Beard Awards, announced the decision in a video posted April 21st. I'm not going to go into details and not going to make excuses, Waz said. We did more than we ever thought we could. A sister location in downtown Durham remains open. Cheney Durham is alive and well, and who knows where we'll go next, Waz said. The closure adds to a string of well-known restaurants shutting down in Raleigh. Capital Club 16 closed its downtown space at the end of April with plans to transition to on-site catering. In Glenwood South, Armadillo Grill abruptly closed last month after more than 20 years in business. In the Village District, Raleigh Bank sells for a big number. A newly completed Fifth Third Bank building has sold to a New York investor. The Mapama Corp. bought the new Fifth Third Bank property for $6.9 million at 615 Oberlin Road. The building is 2,775 square feet, has a drive-through ATM, and is near the Village District Retail Center. The bank sits on 0.64 acres. Fifth Third Bank has signed a 20-year lease for the location. SRS Capital Markets Managing Principals Matthew Masabi and Patrick Luther represented the sellers. Raleigh developers Vanguard Property Group and Greenville developer Brody Co. The sale closed at 4.86% cap rate. Endowment for UNC had tough financial year. Protesters on the campus at UNC Chapel Hill probably aren't the only ones unhappy with the school's endowment. Carolina's endowment, which has been in the news as protesters demand it divest of any interest aligned with Israel, had a tough financial year in fiscal 2023. In fact, the $5.1 billion fund returned a negative 0.4% for the fiscal year after strong years in 2021 and 2022. The reason is the fund shifted more capital to private equity, and its investments there returned a negative 12.3%. It was the fund's first loss since 2016 and came despite strong returns on the American stock market. Ouch. Meredith to add nursing school. The Board of Trustees at Meredith College has approved the formation of a new nursing program amid an ongoing shortage in North Carolina and the U.S. The college plans to launch the program in time for freshman students to enroll in Meredith in the fall of 2025, with the goal of being admitted into the nursing program in 2027. But first, the program needs to be reviewed and approved by the North Carolina Board of Nursing. North Carolina is expected to have a shortage of nearly 12,500 registered nurses by 2033. While demand for these positions is increasing, the number of graduates is not keeping up. The number of annual bachelor's degrees in nursing programs awarded by universities in North Carolina has risen from 2,129 in 2012 to 3,416. But the number of associate's degrees awarded has remained relatively flat, increasing only from 2,472 in 2012 to 2,483 in 2021, according to a recent report prepared by RTI International for the North Carolina Healthcare Association. Beloved antique store in Raleigh to close. An antique store that has been a Raleigh favorite for three decades will close June 1st, stunning fans who followed it from Five Points to 1930 Wake Forest Road, and we're talking about Acquisitions Limited. I'm almost 60, and I've decided to make a change to continue what I love, but at a sustainable pace and with my new partner, Thomas. Owner Ross Spain wrote on Instagram. Spain said he and partner Thomas Ard will launch a new venture with a focus on travel. We will be partnering with some of our favorite villas and estates that you will get to call your European home, Spain said. Lauren Onasorge writes the tech and startups section. Her top story, YouTubers buy assets out of bankruptcy. YouTubers and land-flipping entrepreneurs are getting ready to take on assets of bankrupt drone technology firm Precision Hawk at a steep discount. A chunk of Precision Hawk, which is based in Raleigh and had raised more than $90 million in outside capital since its inception, is being sold for just $150,000. Precision Hawk filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy liquidation in December, reporting assets of just over $3.8 million and debts of nearly $17.6 million. As part of the liquidation process, Precision Hawk's assets went up for sale via public auction, including Droners.io, a Precision Hawk-owned network of commercial drone pilots. The Apke brothers, YouTubers with nearly 16,000 subscribers, put up the winning bid for $150,000. Daniel Apke says Droners.io has been critical in their land acquisition strategy, particularly as he's usually making decisions off-site. We always rely on drones to go, he says of prospective land deals. We give them a set of questions to ask when they're there, and they get certain shots. It's Droners.io that typically connects the brothers to drone operators. Without it, Apke sees a major gap in the industry. So the brothers decided to take a chance, traveling to Raleigh for the auction, their first experience buying via a bankruptcy liquidation. The plan is to operate Droners.io as a standalone company, but also uses technology internally at Apke Brothers' other ventures, he says. Red Hat buy paying off for IBM. 5 years after IBM closed on Raleigh open source firm Red Hat in a $34 billion deal, Big Blue is still singing its praises, even as it works to close another buy, that of HashiCorp. IBM executives, speaking on an earnings call, told analysts Red Hat revenue grew 9%. OpenShift, Red Hat's hybrid cloud platform, was up 40% in its latest quarter. Ansible, once a Durham company acquired by Red Hat in 2015, was up double digits, Chief Financial Officer Jim Cavanaugh told analysts. We are very, very pleased with Red Hat, CEO Arvind Krishna said. IBM executives also used the call to answer questions about the company's $6.4 billion acquisition of California infrastructure cloud company HashiCorp, saying integration could follow a similar playback to what happened with Red Hat. Hashi will be an accelerant to the open source unit's portfolio, Krishna said. Hashy is a nice ad for the Red Hat portfolio, but it's not inside Red Hat. Hashy will be measured in software, but in IBM software, not in Red Hat, Krishna said. And finally, RDU on the short list for Avelo expansion. As Avelo Airlines starts to finalize its inaugural international network, Raleigh-Durham International Airport is still on the radar. CEO Andrew Levy says there's a definite possibility RDU could see more Avelo routes in its not-too-distant future, including perhaps a nonstop to an unserved destination in the Caribbean. We expect to be in a position to announce some new international service as early as this summer, he says. Right now, he doesn't know if RDU will be one of the initial markets flying to the Caribbean, but he's not ruling it out, in part due to the presence of an Avelo crew base at RDU. About 80 Avelo employees work out of the base. RDU has long listed leisure destinations such as the Caribbean as one of its connectivity priorities. In recent years, it has attracted both Copa Airlines and Bahamas Air. Copa debuts a nonstop to Panama City in June. Turning now to the On Healthcare and Higher Education section, this one is written by Zach Ezone. Pfizer gene therapy gets FDA approval. A massive manufacturing facility in North Carolina will play a key role in Pfizer rolling out the commercial launch of its first gene therapy to be approved in the U.S. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently approved Pfizer's gene therapy Becfez for the rare genetic bleeding disorder hemophilia B. It marks the large pharmaceutical company's first gene therapy approval in the U.S., an area of medicine where the company has invested heavily in North Carolina in recent years. The company in 2017 said it would invest $100 million in a gene therapy manufacturing facility at its 230-acre site in Sanford. A few years later, Pfizer disclosed plans to invest an additional $500 million in the facility to advance its pipeline of gene therapy programs targeting diseases including hemophilia A and B and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The expansion, now complete, totaled an investment of more than $600 million over the past several years, according to a Pfizer spokesperson. The company has established the site as one of the most technically advanced gene therapy manufacturing sites that can support commercial supply needs. The facility has multi-product gene therapy suites that use cutting-edge science and technology that have the capability to increase Pfizer's supply of gene therapies for patients with rare diseases around the world, a spokesperson said. This includes the production of Becfez. The FDA-approved Becfez is as a one-time treatment for adults with moderate to severe hemophilia B, a rare genetic bleeding disorder that prevents normal blood clotting. According to the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation, there are 30,000 to 33,000 people with hemophilia in the United States, with hemophilia B being about four times less common than hemophilia A. Pfizer plans to make the treatment available to eligible patients this quarter. The wholesale acquisition cost for a one-time dose of Becfez in the U.S. is $3.5 million per dose before any sort of insurance and rebates. This is in line with the pricing of CSL Behring's Hemgenix, a gene therapy approved by the FDA in late 2022 for hemophilia B. Gene therapies often come with substantial price tags in the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, but as a one-time therapy targeting difficult diseases, these medicines are intended to create value by reducing long-term medical and treatment burdens and costs. Becfez is also a medicine with a compelling value proposition that can deliver savings for the healthcare system when you consider potential long-term benefits that would offset costs that are associated with chronic disease management today, a Pfizer spokesperson said. LabCorp bids $239 million for bankrupt firm. Burlington's LabCorp is offering to buy the assets of the genetics company Invitae for $239 million in cash through a bankruptcy court auction. Prior to filing for bankruptcy, Invitae had big plans in North Carolina. The company in 2021 signed a lease for all 245,159 square feet of office, research, and lab space at a new development called The Stitch, the former site of the Morrisville Outlet Mall off Airport Boulevard off of Interstate 40. The lease term runs through 2035. Invitae had described the Morrisville move as a way to further expand its capacity to meet the growing demand for genetic testing services. The project represented a nearly $115 million investment that would create 374 jobs over multiple years. The state's Economic Investment Committee approved a job development investment grant for the project totaling $6.7 million. Diagnostics firm leaves Boston for RTP. The diagnostics company Immunovia is moving its lab and U.S. headquarters from Marlborough, Massachusetts, outside Boston, to Research Triangle Park. The move is part of a broader effort to streamline operations and lower costs following significant layoffs last year. The Swedish company did not respond to requests for comment. It is unclear how much space it is taking in RTP. The lab in RTP is significantly smaller and less expensive than the company's facility in Massachusetts, CEO Jeff Borcherding said during a conference call April 29th. Additionally, the lower cost of living in the Triangle compared to the Boston area could help the company spend less on new hires. Ben Tobin writes a section on Greater Triangle growth. In Pitt County, clean energy firm Pix Greenville. An international clean energy company says it will invest hundreds of millions of dollars in a facility in Greenville, a plan that calls for hundreds of new jobs. Boviet, or Bovier, Solar of Vietnam, will spend nearly $300 million to establish a 1 million square foot facility with more than 900 jobs. Incentives for the project were approved April 26th during a meeting of the state's Economic Investment Committee, part of the NC Commerce Department. The company is eligible for a JDIG grant worth more than $8 million. Greenville beat out sites in Phoenix and Atlanta. The company told the state that the average wages for the jobs will be around $53,000. The facility will be located at the Greenville Industrial Park. We are proud of bringing our manufacturing excellence to our most important solar market, creating jobs and making a positive impact on North Carolina's economy, says Jimmy Z, general manager of Boviet Solar. This marks the largest jobs investment tied to state incentives in North Carolina so far in 2024. Boviet Solar is a Tier 1 solar technology company that specializes in manufacturing solar panels. It was founded in 2013 and does not have manufacturing operations in the United States. The company says it will create 908 jobs in Greenville by 2028. The new facility is a major economic win for Greenville, which continues to attract business investments, best known as being the home of East Carolina University and famous YouTuber Mr. Beast. The city's population sat at just shy of 90,000 in 2022. Another company, Thermo Fisher Scientific, has pushed major expansion plans in Greenville in recent years. Economic leaders in the city have been working to get big investments like these. In February, Triangle Business Journal reported that the Greenville Eastern North Carolina Alliance, a public-private partnership, sold land in the Indy Green Corporate Park off Sugg Parkway to Marlboro Development Team, Incorporated of South Carolina. The real estate developer plans to build a Class A industrial building that will have 100,440 square feet of space and be expandable to 234,360 square feet. The Boviet Solar investment comes as North Carolina has been making a push to attract clean tech companies. Between 2017 and 2023, the state announced more than 17,500 jobs in the clean energy sector, representing projects totaling $22.1 billion in capital investment. In Chatham County, Siler City beats Dallas and Phoenix for a 150-job investment. A subsidiary of one of the nation's largest home builders is making a sizable investment in Chatham County that will create more than 150 jobs. Innovative Construction Group, which has acquired by Pulte Group in 2020, is investing roughly $40 million in operations in Siler City, which the company says will create 157 jobs over a five-year period. Innovative Construction Group plans to build a new manufacturing facility in Siler City. The plan is to reach full operations in 2029. Innovate Construction deals in off-site construction of single-family and multifamily wood frame housing. The company based in Jacksonville, Florida, is eligible for more than $1 million in state incentives, as voted on by the state's Economic Investment Committee April 23rd, as well as another $1.1 million in combined incentives from Chatham County and Siler City. The average wage for the new jobs will be above $52,000. Other sites evaluated for the project included Dallas and Phoenix. And along those lines, also in Chatham County, developers grab more land in Pittsboro. The development firm behind the massive Chatham Park community has made another splash in Chatham County with a major purchase. An LLC tied to Preston Development Company of Cary purchased three separate parcels that totaled more than 120 acres in Pittsboro across two different deeds, one dated March 20th, the other April 18th, for $12 million, according to Chatham County deed records. The land is located around U.S. Route 64 and Hanks Chapel Road. This is a parcel we have had under contract for quite some time, says Vanessa Jenkins, Executive Vice President of Preston Development. Plans are most likely residential. The real estate section is written by Kaylee Thompson. In downtown Raleigh, rooftop restaurant with sky bar opens. Downtown Raleigh now has another option for rooftop views while dining. La Terraza, the new rooftop restaurant and bar on the ninth floor of The Dillon in the Warehouse District, opened recently. The Southern Italian and Mediterranean restaurant is the product of Samad Hachby or Hackby, owner of Molino Italian Kitchen, and his group Umbria Hospitality. Hachby originally planned to open last spring but ran into some snags with building on the ninth floor of a building where there were other tenants. He says it was a challenge to work around the small elevators and accommodate the working costs of the other tenants, likening the construction to building an airplane. Hackby also struggled to find staff to ensure the right atmosphere was created. The menu features dishes that include calamari, duck, pork, Roman pizza, rack of lamb, beef rossini, and house-made fresh pasta. Hatchby says the most popular dishes have been arrosticini, which is grilled skewers of lamb, chicken, and beef, crudi, a choice from salmon scallops or tuna tartare, and carciofi alla romana, which is braised artichokes and golden potatoes. The restaurant seats 100 people inside and about 90 people on the outdoor patio, with views of downtown, courtesy of the floor-to-ceiling windows. Hatchby loves the energy the place has, especially because of all the natural light that is let into the restaurant. In addition to the wide open views, the patio features ceiling fans and heaters so guests can enjoy the view year-round. Hatchby initially expected the build out of the restaurant to be about $1.5 million, but it ended up being about $2.5 million. La Terraza opens as the downtown food scene remains in a state of flux, with restaurants closing or potentially leaving downtown while new concepts open. Two restaurants, Gonza Tacos y Tequila on Hillsborough Street and Capital Club 16 at the corner of Salisbury and Martin Streets, recently closed. Near 440 Midtown Raleigh eyed for apartment tower. A 10-story apartment building could be coming to Midtown Raleigh just inside the Beltline. New site plans have been filed for Mellow Field, a mid-rise apartment building near the Interstate 440 and Capitol Boulevard 401 interchange. Mellow Field Investments, LLC, addressed to REIT Place Rentals out of Cary, is listed as the developer. It also owns the property, acquiring it in January 2022 for $310,000. REIT Place Rentals is a real estate investment management and development company. However, Triangle Business Journal was informed that the developer is CCI Equity, with the broker being REIT Place. Site plans for 2661 Mellow Field Drive show there will be 234 units, 148 one-bedrooms, and 86 two-bedrooms. Five of the units will be two-floor townhome-style units. Most of the units will have balconies. The cost and construction timeline are unknown. And in Morrisville, Carlyle Group snaps up homes near RDU. A global private equity firm has spent nearly $22 million on townhomes near Raleigh-Durham International Airport. An LLC addressed to the Carlyle Group acquired 58 townhomes for $21.5 million in Morrisville, according to Durham County deed records. The townhomes, named Adobe Arrington, were built and sold by DRB Group and are now available for lease. The price comes to about $371,000 per home. Adobe Arrington has 65 townhomes total, but only 58 are owned by the Carlyle Group so far. The firm, based in Washington, D.C., started buying the homes in December, with the most recent sale occurring on April 23rd. Turning to the cover story this week, charting the region's future, planning boards play a vital role in growth, and Ben Tobin is the author of this story. Jennifer Scott knows what it's like to be on both sides of a planning board. The Triangle attorney started a 3-year stint on the Chatham County Planning Board more than 20 years ago, well before the 7,100-acre Chatham Park changed the growth trajectory of the county. Back then, like all planning board members, Scott was tasked with deciding on everything from rezoning to special use permit applications from developers. Now, Scott is one of the representing developers before the planning board. Through her work as general counsel for Raleigh developer Windjam Companies and as an attorney with the Shipman and Wright law firm, and her strategy informed by her time on the board is clear: lobby, lobby, lobby. Some developers really don't do the lobbying piece, Scott says. They just sort of go in and expect that they're going to be able to present the project and answer the questions, and that they're going to move right through. Planning boards only have recommendation power. The actual yes or no vote on applications comes from town or county councils or boards of commissioners. But a planning board recommendation for approval can propel a project forward, while one for a rejection could be a death knell. No municipality is the same in the Triangle, but planning board members and elected officials wrestle with the same questions that surround growth, such as how much density to allow or if the water and sewer infrastructure is sufficient. And many of those conversations begin and can end at planning boards, where the members are volunteers and longtime civic leaders have concerns about filling those vital roles. In the competitive atmosphere of buying land and pitching new developments, developers have to quickly get a feel for each municipality and their respective planning boards. If not, they risk rejection and missing out on the wave of growth the region is seeing. For Scott, the key is getting to know planning board members and selectively reaching out on important issues. You have to do some real gut checks on the front end, because if you go to a planning board member over and over there, they become less receptive, Scott says. It's a volunteer position, and it takes a lot of time. I pick my battles. If there's something that's controversial, that's the one I come to see them about. Triangle Business Journal spoke with 4 elected officials who previously served on a planning board across 4 different Greater Triangle municipalities. None of them are running for elections this year. Here are their stories. The first one is Edward Gleason from Creedmoor. Edward Gleason has been civically engaged his entire life. Nearly 70 years ago, the 77-year-old commissioner helped his grandfather campaign for public office in the New York town of Clarkstown. Gleason later became a fire chief in New York. After driving through the city of Creedmoor for a food tasting for their daughter's wedding, Gleason and his wife moved to the town just north of Durham in 2009. Gleason joined the city's planning board in 2011 and rose to become chair before being appointed to the city's board of commissioners in 2022. I've probably attended more city council meetings than anybody that goes to any meeting in Creedmoor, Gleason says. I've been involved, standing up and saying my piece for a long time now. I've missed maybe roughly 20 city council meetings since my time moving here. Creedmoor, with a population of a little more than 5,000, isn't seeing the explosive growth that other Triangle municipalities are having. Per data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the municipality's population sat at 2,253 in 2000, rising up to more than 4,100 in 2010. But the past 10 years have seen less than 100 people move to Creedmoor per year. Part of the problem in Creedmoor is sewer and water capacity. Currently, the Southern Granville Water and Sewer Authority, SGWASA, is working on a $75 million project to repair and replace pipes and pumps throughout the utility. That project could be completed by 2028. Creedmoor has very intentionally kept its housing stock to medium-density single-family homes, Gleason says, that while it's important to maintain the character of certain areas, developments like Creedmoor Village, a mixed-use community right by Interstate 85, targeting a maximum of 500 low-density housing units, need to be allowed to promote growth. It's hard to make people understand that we still need to grow. If we don't grow, the fire trucks will continue to get older, the police cars will need to be replaced, buildings will need to be repaired, and without growth, all of these costs would have to be passed along to the ones that are already here. With the completion of the SGWASA Water and Sewer Project, Gleason estimates that Southern Granville County will see a population growth of 30% to 40% over the next decade. But what concerns Gleason is that enthusiasm for joining planning boards in Creedmoor and other municipalities throughout the Triangle region is dipping despite the impact those boards can have as the Triangle overall maps a future marked by growth. We don't have a great amount of interest in people that want to be on a planning board, he says. People's lives are different than they were 20 years ago. Young people are having a harder time taking care of their families and being available to attend meetings. The second person highlighted by the TBJ this week is Andrea Archer in Clayton. Andrea Archer's introduction to the Clayton Town Council was leading a charge to get the town to legalize backyard chickens. Archer was an active volunteer in the farmers market and wanted to have backyard chickens for their eggs. She and others were not initially successful, but the town did legalize backyard chickens in December 2021. Archer, a geologist from Michigan who works in Raleigh with the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, has been civically minded, volunteering with Clayton Junior Women's Club on top of the farmers market when moving to the area in 2006. She jumped at the chance to join the Clayton Planning Board in 2017. I was willing to show up, to do the homework, to have to use my brain to get creative places and to drive to places for applications, Archer says. What I wasn't expecting was the more human emotional side of it to be so intense. Clayton has grown so much, and so many things were coming through the planning board that were pretty new. More planned and denser subdivisions, smaller and homogeneous housing. A lot of the larger planned neighborhoods that had already been in existence were custom built and had larger lot sizes. So something different was coming and people were wrapping their heads around it. After serving a four-year stint, including 2 years as chair, Archer was elected to a four-year term on the Clayton Town Council in the fall of 2021. Clayton's growth has been explosive. The Johnston County town's population hovers just below 30,000 residents, up from 16,116 in 2010, and the high-density planned subdivisions that Archer referenced aren't slowing down. The Copper District, a mixed-use development at the intersection of the U.S. Highway 70 bypass and NC Highway 42 near the future 540 loop, promises more than 800 homes. Home builder Pulte Group of Atlanta is looking to rezone 362.75 acres off Brook Hill Drive to clear the way for a community with a maximum of 750 homes. And Hopper Communities of Charlotte is working on a 335-home subdivision off Vinson Road. For Archer, balance and nuance is the key when it comes to making decisions on massive proposed projects. There's not a right and wrong with development, she says. Like anyone who tells me they know an application is the absolute right thing or the absolute wrong thing, I'm skeptical of it because usually the answer is somewhere in the middle. That philosophy applies to how Archer views residential real estate developments in Clayton. A mix of densities and prices is important for the town to grow. The priority shouldn't be in any one category, Archer says. We need to have a balance of all these options, and especially at both ends of the spectrum where you have attainable and affordable housing and some higher-end executive housing. To responsibly manage a municipality, you need all types of places for all income levels and backgrounds. Bill Pate has deep connections to Southern Pines. Bill Pate loved growing up in Southern Pines and didn't hesitate to move back as an adult. Pate, an attorney focused on estate planning, business law, and real estate, always had an interest in governance. He participated in student government in high school and jumped at the opportunity to join the Southern Pines Planning Board in 2015. He says that his background as an attorney has helped with his tasks as a planning board member and now as Southern Pines Mayor Pro Tem. He was first elected to the town council in 2019. Being an attorney of any practice area, you sort of learn how to analyze data and how to process things, Pate says. Probably the biggest thing it has helped with is just learning the process. Every decision or every analysis is based on some sort of criteria or some sort of set of rules that you compare the facts against. The town, once seen as a retirement hub for people who wanted a slower pace of life and access to world-class golf courses, has become younger and is growing. Per census estimates, the median age of Southern Pines residents dropped from 48.8 to 38.4, from 2010 to 2022. The town's population surged from 12,334 residents to 16,596 during that period. With the influx, Pate has seen a thrust of multifamily developments being pitched. In response, the town council recently completed a 2040 comprehensive plan that includes comments on what parts of town are most appropriate for multifamily developments, Pate says. One big thing from that whole comprehensive plan project is we definitely want to protect the character of Southern Pines, he says. We want new developments and projects to look nice, but we want them to function well. Southern Pines puts a heavy emphasis on architectural design. One of the biggest discussions the town council has had in recent years is about a 148,000 square foot Target store being placed in the 100-acre Morganton Park South development. The main debate over the Target was over its look, with one council member calling the design insulting and not cute. Another big development item Pate and his fellow council members will face in the years ahead is the introduction of conditional zoning to the Southern Pines Unified Development Ordinance. Conditional zoning applications are typically used for large-scale rezonings like mixed-use districts, where officials vote to approve certain developments based on a list of conditions. Overall, Pate says his time on the planning board has helped prepare him for these challenges on the council. It takes a while to learn all the processes, project components, and acronyms associated with the planning projects, Pate says. Being on a planning board helps you get immensely ahead of the learning curve. And the final individual being featured this week is Bill Lump of Nashville. Bill Lump moved to Nash County when he was 10 years old and has called it home for most of his life. The real estate agent bounced around to different parts of the region before arriving in Nashville roughly 7 years ago. Lump says it didn't take long for him to be approached to be on the Nashville Planning Board due to his connections in the area and background. People knew I'd be a good fit for planning board because of my background in real estate, so they asked me to be part of it, he says. Lump served 5 years on the planning board before being elected to the Nashville Town Council in the fall. He says the biggest surprise about being on planning board was the lack of appreciation for its recommendations on certain projects. The planning board didn't really have any say, Lump says. They could recommend what the council should do, but if the council didn't agree, they could vote differently. I didn't realize that. So it was just kind of an eye-opening experience when you realize the group of people that volunteered their time to learn and discuss important topics really didn't hold water until the council got a hold of it. Lump pointed to Rocky Mountains as an example of something he wants to see in Nashville. With zoning cases in Rocky Mount, before the council rejects a recommendation from the planning board, the two bodies hold a joint meeting to discuss the application, according to Rocky Mount spokesman Grant Robertson. Unlike many greater triangle towns, Nashville has seen just a trickle of residents arrive in recent years. Per census estimates as of 2022, the town's population stood at 5,695, an increase of only 343 from 2010. But growth is on the horizon as Nashville and the county offer a lower cost of living and cheaper available land than others closer to the core of the Research Triangle. Lump says that he is pro-growth but wants to maintain a sense of community and is wary of becoming a place where you can only have apartments or condensed properties. Like council members in surrounding municipalities, Lump says he is okay with apartments so long as they are in specific areas. One development that fits the bill of the type of investment he hopes to see in Nashville is Nashville Junction, a mixed-use project that includes the redevelopment of the former Nashville Building Supply Company building at 723 South Barnes Street. That project received approval in 2021 and will include retail, a farmer's market, and three 24-unit apartment buildings. Lump says that while he was on the planning board, there was discussion of placing the apartment component near single-family homes, something that Lump opposed. Now the plan is for the apartments to be near the junction and downtown, which he supports. We turned a negative into a positive, Lump says. We had a developer who wanted to do something that we didn't think was right for the town. We fought him, but we also embraced him. I think it's going to be a great thing for our town, and we're lucky he stuck with us. But at the same time, we're going to hold our stance when someone wants to do something that we don't think is right. The Editor's Notebook column this week, as always, is written by Sugata Mukherjee, the Editor-in-Chief of Triangle Business Journal. Some of the world's premier research experts have announced the use of artificial intelligence in the workplace will forever change the landscape of how companies operate and the skills needed for workers to have jobs. In an article written by Forbes Technology Council member Charles Simon, it was noted that AI will replace 85 million jobs by 2025, but will create 97 million new jobs. IBM's 2022 report on AI noted that 30% of information technology professionals use AI and automation tools to save time. A CompTIA report on the 2024 AI outlook notes that 22% of tech companies are aggressively pursuing AI integration into their practices, and about 45% of the companies are in the exploration stage. That's where the exploration percentage is underreported. Truthfully, AI has become a buzzword. In recent months, I have talked to a few board members of public companies who have told me that implementation and exploration of AI are topics shared at board meetings, and directors have also asked the CEO questions about the impact. However, more importantly, it should be noted that the same directors note little progress has been made at these companies. But Wall Street does not look that way. Mention AI in your earnings call, press release, or initial public offerings and watch prices jump. Led by NVIDIA, and rightfully so, since it designs and supplies the graphics processing units, that's GPUs, and application programming interfaces, APIs, for data science, that's the AI nucleus, the rise in the stock price of all the well-known tech companies in the past 12 months has been borderline silly. Each of the so-called Magnificent Seven stocks, that's NVIDIA, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, Apple, and Tesla, gained at least 49% in 2023, and Wall Street soared on their backs. Well, 2024 has yet to show that kind of enthusiasm. In first quarter 2024, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Amazon, and Meta continued to rise, jumping 12%, 82%, 19%, and 37% respectively. Apple and Tesla were down for the quarter, 11% and 29% respectively, and Alphabet struggled before ending the first 3 months of the year up by 8%. So what about the other public companies that have vociferously noted to shareholders and investors that they are all in on the application of generative AI? Their stocks have surged, but has it come down to earth like Apple and Google? So the other shoe has yet to drop. What worries me more is whether the lost jobs will come long before the new AI jobs, as suggested by the Forbes author. While cutting the workforce improves operating costs, companies will come under cultural stress to grow, so cutting the workforce is always a temporary solution. According to a recent report of 750 business leaders using AI from Resume Builder, 37% say that technology replaced workers in 2023. Meanwhile, 44% report that there will be layoffs in 2024 from AI efficiency. My point is that all we have talked about is AI's potential and how it can generate wealth and make companies efficient. That forced companies to jump on the bandwagon quickly and notice the sharp northward movement of their market cap. But how much of it is real, and when will Wall Street notice? You can reach Mr. Mukherjee at Sugata, S-O-U-G-A-T-A, at bizjournals.com. This week's 52 Shades of Success, The Latino Influence, is headlined An Educated Boost. An effort is underway to improve representation, recruitment, and retention of Hispanic educators. The article is by Connie Gentry. Recruitment, retention, and representation are focal points for Latinx leaders working to build equity in North Carolina's education system. While roughly 20% of K-12 students in the state's public schools are Hispanic or Latino, there's a disconcerting gap in representation for these students, with only 4% of educational professionals in our public schools identifying as Hispanic or Latino. Latinx Ed shared these findings in its recent report, Nuestra Esperanza, What Latinx Education Leaders Need to Thrive. And in a correlating webinar, Lucia Lozano Robledo, curriculum and program specialist at Latinx Ed, asserted that achieving education equity goes beyond the classroom. An education leader is someone who uses their power and voice to advocate for education issues that impact marginalized communities. We need everybody to see themselves as part of this movement. In the report, Latinx Ed assimilated best practices from education leaders around the state to help foster a conversation around sustainable recruitment, retention, and longevity. We want emphasis on longevity because folks are burning out, especially teachers and educators of color are burning out at a fast rate, Robledo said. Burnout was rampant among North Carolina educators in the last year. with more than 10,000 professionals leaving their jobs in the 2022-23 school year, according to the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction annual report, which cited teacher attrition at 11.5%, up from 7.8% the year prior. The problem was most pronounced among those who had been teaching 3 years or less, and in that cohort, the attrition rate topped 15%. On the positive front, teacher recruitment in fall 2023 outpaced that of attrition, with more than 11,000 educators hired following the exodus of 10,373 educators the previous school year. Isa Herrera, Director of Community Advancement at Casa Azul de Wilson, is intent on building representation among educators and other professions. Herrera joined the Carolina College Advising Corps when she graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 2019 and began working in two Chatham County high schools, one with predominantly white demographics and the other predominantly Hispanic students. It was a dual reality for her, similar to the dichotomy she experienced in her own high school career when she was focused on academic success while helping care for her seven younger siblings at home. The third oldest in a family of 10 children, she was born and raised in Wilson to parents who immigrated from Mexico. I realized the impact I had as a Latina student helping to guide other Hispanic students when more than 43 families showed up for my first FAFSA night at Jordan Matthews High School. That's when I realized the power of representation, says Herrera, who not only sent flyers in Spanish and English, but also called parents and talked to them in their native language about why they should attend the financial aid discussions. It's a very personal conversation for her because the cost of attending Chapel Hill had seemed insurmountable. Bedingfield High was predominantly a black and brown school, and it was a really big thing when I was one of two students in my class accepted to Chapel Hill. But I had full-ride scholarships to two smaller schools, Herrera says. Then she found out about the Carolina Covenant financial aid package, which enables qualified students from low-income families to attend and graduate debt-free, and she earned a spot as one of the Carolina Covenant scholars. Herrera saw similar needs in Chatham County and Wilson County schools, where Hispanic students make up 32% and 24% of enrollment, respectively. And at both Jordan Matthews and Bedingfield High Schools, more than three-quarters of the students are economically disadvantaged. The difference was that Wilson County did not have support organizations in place to help its students, so she and her older sister, Flor Herrera Picasso, returned to their hometown and co-founded Casa Azul de Wilson in 2021. I've been in college advising for 4 years, and this has been the hardest year because of the financial aid changes with FAFSA, says Herrera, explaining that as of January, the process requires parents to complete their own account online, and it is more challenging for those who don't have a Social Security number to do this. I was really concerned about this change because it was already hard for parents who didn't understand the concept of FAFSA, and especially in rural counties and mixed status families where students are eligible for financial aid, but their parents do not have a Social Security number. All these changes have created more distrust, she says. You can see the effects on mixed status families because we have such a lower rate of people submitting the FAFSA. Although Herrera has already advised 107 students in the first 4 months of this year, compared to a total of 109 students across the entire 2022-2023 FAFSA application period, 35% of the FAFSA applications that students had started had not been completed and submitted by mid-April, presumably because they still lacked the electronic parent's signature. Casa Azul has had students from 18 counties, primarily in rural eastern North Carolina, reach out for guidance this year compared to advising students from five counties in years past. I think this FAFSA change unintentionally targeted a certain group of people that were going to see a decline in enrollment of Latino students into higher education because of it, she says, adding that the recent recommendation from the UNC system to reduce spending and commitment to DEI efforts will also have a negative impact. The UNC Board of Governors will vote on repealing or replacing the 2019 DEI policy at its meeting on May 23rd. We are moving backwards. It's really hard as a Latina to be in education trying to motivate other Latinos to pursue higher education when this is just another way to keep us out, Herrera says. Dayson Passion, teacher advisor in the office of Governor Roy Cooper, concurs that this is not the direction our university should be adopting. Like Herrera, he's a U.S. citizen born in New York to immigrant parents from Colombia. He spent his career in building equity in education with 9 years in the classroom as a science teacher before assuming this role in the governor's office in 2021. Except for educators teaching Spanish classes, the first time he had a teacher who Pachon says looked like me was in the second semester of his doctorate program. The expectation has been that Latino educators teach Spanish or English as a second language, not that they're science teachers or teaching math or history, he notes. Last year, he led the governor's task force in Tarboro, Pembroke, Asheville, and Winston-Salem to highlight regional and district-level programs that could serve as models in other locations around the state for increasing educator diversity. Almost all had a grow-your-own program where a district was working with a university to grow and cultivate their own educators from high school students interested in the teaching profession, Pachon says. The programs included a partnership with a university or with foundations to provide scholarships with the intention that the students would come back and teach in that district. Diversity in education is important not only for the representation it creates for students of color, but also for their cultural understanding and appreciation it fosters among all communities. As someone who did not see myself in teachers or school leaders, I think it's important for all students to not only see themselves represented, but also to learn from someone who they may not identify with strongly, Pachon says. Our schools are a great way for students to learn about the wealth of knowledge that different cultures can bring to a community, and ultimately it has an opportunity to grow stronger, more cohesive communities. The 52 Shades of Success, the Latino Influence, explores the challenges and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by those in the Latin American community from all across the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. This 52-week project will also dive into important trends and issues relating to the DEI sector. In the news this week, effort pushes to link Raleigh and Wilmington. Wilmington businessman Gene Merritt and his father spent 12 years lobbying for Interstate 40. Now Merritt, owner of GMC Real Estate, is about to do it again, this time for a commuter rail line that will connect the triangle to the coast. Just as when he co-founded I-40 Inc. decades ago, he's co-founded an entity with the sole purpose of selling the state and local communities on a passenger rail line that would run between Raleigh and Wilmington. Merritt has teamed up with Wilmington media consultant Steve Unger on a nonprofit Eastern Carolina Rail. He and Unger are hosting symposiums throughout the corridor trying to rally public support for train stations. We have found almost no one who doesn't like this idea, Merritt says. It's not a partisan thing. With the I-40 effort, we met in every little town along the route, trying to get the communities involved and trying to fire people up. Now he's doing it again, but it's an expensive, complicated endeavor. The rail route, as envisioned, nearly parallels I-40 and would carry an estimated 80,000 riders between the two cities at a cost of under $30 a ride. Commuters would hop on a train and work on the way via Amtrak's Wi-Fi. The biggest barrier could be the rising cost of the project. An updated report conducted by engineering firm WGI Inc. shows the price estimate from the previous study of the 134-mile-long project is $810 million. Initially, the line was expected to cost between $65 million and $185 million, but that was years ago. Unger says he's not surprised at the price tag amid inflation and that the project will still go through. Merritt and Unger see a need, both in increasing freight traffic from the Port of Wilmington, currently served by a single rail line, and adding passenger rail to the mix. Right now, the closest Amtrak train station to Wilmington is in Fayetteville. As envisioned, the Raleigh to Wilmington project could provide new service on an existing CSX alignment, but part of the line has been abandoned and would have to be entirely redone, and new stations would have to be added. There have been inroads that give Merritt and Unger confidence the effort will find the same success as I-40 Inc. all those years ago. The Durham Bulls owner says, "We can't object to Raleigh getting an MLB team. Raleigh's dreams of landing a Major League Baseball franchise won't be blocked by the Durham Bulls." Bulls owner Jim Goodman, the chairman of Capital Broadcasting Company, says the Bulls have a contractual relationship with MLB that would allow the majors to put a team in the market regardless of the view of the minor league team already there. In our agreement, all the minor league teams, if Major League Baseball puts in a team, then MLB will help you move and you get compensation for it, he says. Goodman's point is significant in that the Bulls have always drawn heavily from Wake County. Raleigh remains one of the largest cities in the United States without a baseball team and has not had a professional team since the early 70s. But Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon is eager to land one for the city and has a deal with the Centennial Authority where he can develop the land around PNC Arena. You can get a public-private partnership to build a great stadium, and I think the people would support it, Dundon told the Sports Business Journal. The revenues would do really well here, and we could sell tickets and sponsorships to be of value to Major League Baseball. In 2021, Major League Baseball revamped its relationship with the minor leagues and invited 120 minor league teams to be a part of its new system and agreed to sign professional development licenses. As for the Bulls, the team has always argued it's a great outlet for baseball fans in Raleigh and is only half an hour from the capital city, depending on traffic. The Bulls, with a rich history that includes the film Bull Durham in 1988, remains one of the most popular teams in the minors. If Raleigh were to land a major league franchise, the Bulls would not necessarily move. Goodman says there is a notion that having a AAA team close to a major league team is an advantage. For example, it's much easier to call up minor leaguers when a major league player is hurt or demoted. Raleigh has some advantages as a booming market with the wealthy potential owner in place, but the market faces some significant hurdles to getting a team, hurdles that include cash and compensation. Big number this week, 122, the number of homes Windjam Companies is planning for a neighborhood called Gurley Cove on 85 acres off Ed Herring Road in the Lenore County town of LaGrange. $415 million, that's the size of the mortgage for a 30-hotel portfolio for Courtyard by Marriott Hotels, which includes the Courtyard Raleigh Midtown. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.